This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. Marshall University's Board of Governors was presented with a $116 million balanced budget Wednesday that included a tuition increase. Clark Davis reports.
A tuition increase isn't uncommon in the state's higher education system today. Many of the state's four-year institutions are looking to tuition increases, at least in part, to make up for the state budget cuts. Marshall University's Board of Governors approved an increase of between 3% to 4% for students Wednesday. The increase is less than the 5% threshold that requires the approval from the Higher Education Policy Commission. Marshall Interim President Gary White says they had to come up with new ideas.
We started a zero-based budget process, and that implies that you look at everything you do and you quantify not only those important functions, but what those functions cost. You don't look at the revenue side, you simply look at the efficiency at the expense side. And once those are identified, then you have a target.
It's the third year that not just Marshall, but all higher education institutions in the state have faced budget cuts from the state legislature. How did Marshall deal with that cut and still find a way to get the budget balanced and find money for employee raises? By using new ideas, like White said. Among those was changing the student tuition structure. No longer are there individual lab and course fees. Students pay college fees along with their tuition, and the extra money needed for labs comes from that group. But White says they came up with other ideas, like the implementation of a faculty group to examine the budget. The Marshall 2020 group was created in the fall of 2013 by former President Stephen J. Kopp and has played a large role in identifying areas that can be cut. The group of employees and faculty is comprised from different university departments that are always studying the budget.
We had a cross-section of more than 60 people on this campus who analyzed a number of functions here and came up with about $3 million worth of savings. But I'm not so sure that Marshall isn't the only institution in the state that approached the budget that way. I frankly believe that all institutions, not only in West Virginia but across the nation, are going to have to change their budget model. The old model just doesn't work.
Mary Ellen Houghton is the chief financial officer for the university. She says it's a challenge when you have to think each time before making a decision. Is this decision the right one for the current economic climate?
I mean, it's been a challenge, and we have to work together and figure out, trying to look at across the board strategically, what are the most important places to invest in, and the things that have the biggest impact on the student. We talked about some renovations that are occurring. That's hard money to spend because, we know we have to pay salaries, we know we have to pay, there are certain things we have to pay. But if you don't keep the space up, there's health and safety concerns. You don't want the students to, be in bad space or go to some other school that's doing those things.
Houghton says that it's beginning to become tough for departments throughout the university to have to tighten their belts even more each year.
It's starting to hurt as we change our perspective and just try to think about, what are the most important things that we do. And that's the basis behind this 2020 effort, is to say, we know that the state's going to continue to cut. That was what Dr. Kopp had really realized and said, how do we get prepared for that? You need to look at everything comprehensively as opposed to in silos, which we kind of did in the past.
Houghton says the Marshall 2020 group is already looking at things that could be cut if necessary in next year's budget. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
Today, we are here in a moment of unity in our state without ill will to say it's time to move the flag from the Capitol grounds.
That's Republican Governor Nikki Haley of South Carolina calling for her state to end the practice of displaying the Confederate battle flag on the state Capitol grounds. There's lots of news about the flag this week. Lawmakers in other states are debating whether to remove the flag and other symbols of the Confederacy from public display and from license plates. And some big retailers say they'll stop stocking it. This is all in reaction to the shooting of 9 black people at a South Carolina church. The man who's confessed to the shooting has been photographed posing with Confederate flags. Joining us now is Trey Kay, the host of our podcast, Us and Them. So, Trey, you were already working on a podcast that explored feelings about the flag before this happened.
Yeah, we were. And we'd planned on putting it out later in the season, but we're releasing it this week because of all this news.
So in this installment, you meet again with Alice Moore. She's someone our listeners might be familiar with. She was a Kanawha County School Board member at the center of the textbook controversy back in 1974.
That's right. And Alice is a friend of mine. And last winter, this was way before the shooting, she and I went to a graveyard in Mississippi. And there were lots of graves that were decorated with the Confederate battle flag. And I asked Alice what the flag means to her.
I love what it represents. I love the fact that it was the flag of people who were, stood up and fought for what ended up being a losing cause, but they believed in what they were doing. They knew they were in a minority, but they fought a tremendous battle.
And I asked her if she understood that many people in this country believe the flag is as offensive as a swastika.
Well, are you concerned, or does it bother you that there are people in this country who see that flag as representing their ancestors and a war that was fought against unbelievable odds and fought so bravely and gallantly, and people suffered horribly in the South, and that flag represents their grandfathers and their great-grandfathers, and you're saying, well, there are people who see it otherwise, therefore it's an evil thing, we ought to do away with it. Why?
So, Trey, you talked to Alice Moore about the flag before the shooting. Does she still feel this way now?
She says she does. And she says it's too bad the flag's been used as a symbol by racist groups, because it doesn't mean racism to her. And she's not the only Southerner who feels strong support for the flag. I talked to history professor Ed Baptist about this.
The polls I've seen before the shootings suggested over 70% of white South Carolinians supported keeping the flag on the statehouse grounds. Why is it so important to them? This particular flag was the Confederate battle flag and not the official flag of the Confederacy and so on and so forth, but it's the flag that's become identified with the Confederacy. And the flag was important during the Civil War, but it became important again after, in particular, 1954, Brown versus Board of Education. It started to be used more and more widely as a sort of a rallying emblem for the folks who wanted to defeat what they saw as the rising tide of desegregation and the destruction of Jim Crow and Southern life.
Professor Baptist maintains that the flag is a racist symbol, and he thinks that South Carolina should take it down.
When it was being moved from the Statehouse dome to the to its new site on the Statehouse grounds, in fact, supporters of the flag chanted, "Off the dome and in your face, off the dome and in your face." So it's a giant middle finger to African Americans.
So, Trey, does this entire next episode of Us and Them focus entirely on the Confederate flag?
No, it turns out you can't talk about the flag without also talking about people's other ideas about the war and slavery and racism and whether our ancestors were on the right side of history. So we talk about that, too. And we dig into another Southern icon, the song Dixie.
Well, Trey Kay, this sounds fascinating. Thanks for coming on to talk about this new program.
Thank you, Beth.
Trey Kay is the host of Us and Them. It's our podcast that explores America's cultural divides. The new Us and Them installment comes out at midnight tonight and is available on iTunes. You can also listen to it or get more information at our website, wvpublic.org. This is West Virginia Morning at 7:53. Mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and thunderstorms today. Temperatures in the upper 70s to the mid-80s. A chance of rain and thunderstorms tonight with lows in the mid-60s. To the low 70s. Variable cloudiness tomorrow with highs in the mid 70s to the mid 80s.
Support for West Virginia Public Broadcasting is provided by the West Virginia Division of Rehabilitation Services, enabling and empowering workers with disabilities to meet business workforce needs. Employer services at wvdrs.org. This is West Virginia Public Broadcasting encouraging you to be a supporter of West Virginia Public Broadcasting by calling 1-800-RADIO-87. That's 1-800-RADIO-87. 423-4687 and help support the fine news and public affairs programs on West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
When you think of something being solar powered, what do you picture? Solar panels on roofs, bridges, and fields. But what about a solar musician? Liz McCormick introduces us to a man who says his music is solar powered.
Describe where I'm going and where are we?
So we're at Craftworks at Cool Spring.
That's 32-year-old Graham Smith White. We're walking along a trail surrounded by trees, flowers, and berry bushes just outside of Charlestown. Graham is looking for the perfect spot to produce and record his next piece.
Do you carry all this equipment out?
This is light. This is because I'm not camping.
He's carrying three things: his guitar case, a backpack with two Indian drums inside called tablas, and another smaller bag with cables, microphones, a large battery, and solar panels.
A few years ago, I realized just how much electricity it takes to produce an album, and wanted to see if I could do something to reduce that and change the amount of energy it takes, so then we're not wasting our resources for just for the sake of entertainment, basically. And so I set out figuring out how to do that.
Graham only records in nature. He came up with the idea while attending a music festival in Tennessee.
I was camping in the woods, and I was walking to my campsite, and Toots and the Maytals were sound checking the drums, and the drums were just echoing through the woods, and I had to stop and just appreciate how awesome it sounded. So I decided I wanted to do that. I wanted those sounds.
And he did just that. Around age 27, Graham started putting in motion how he could get sounds of nature into his music and give his songs an organic feel.
I wanted to record music in places where there was no electricity. And my initial thought was to get a generator, because that's sort of an obvious automatic thing in our culture. And there's continual overhead with a generator. You got to keep buying gas, and you have to do maintenance, and there's parts and all that sort of stuff. On top of that, they make noise and they're loud, and I'm trying to record the acoustics of a specific place. And so solar panels were just kind of the best in an automatic option.
We've arrived at a clearing. There's a creek in front of us and a marshland beyond. Graham decides this is the spot. The setup works like this. He has a microphone he plugs into his smartphone, while his smartphone plugs into a battery that's being charged by solar panels he's laid out in a sunny spot in the grass.
I've got a couple different solar setups that I can use depending on what my power needs are and how much weight I'm willing to carry. And they range from a small sort of 7-watt panel that folds up the size of a billfold, just like a typical women's wallet type thing. It fits in my pocket. And today I've got a little bit larger folding panel that's 20 watts and a battery pack that it charges.
Graham can play around 7 different instruments, and if it's just him playing, he records each instrument individually into his smartphone or laptop, then mixes it down later. Sometimes Graham works with others, and sometimes it's just him. But no matter the scenario, he only records outside, and he calls his recording project the Sunrise Review. Graham sits down in front of the creek and starts to play the tablas. After he records the drums, he pulls out a black and red guitar decorated with colorful beads. Graham says the idea is to make music, but also to be an example of how to do right by the planet.
And I'm able to do that by being sustainable and taking concern for how I impact the world I'm in, because it's my office, you know? You wouldn't do things in your office that result in, like, not being able to breathe or having to worry about whether or not the water is clean enough to drink.
Graham has been all over the world to produce his music, the Rockies, the Everglades, Yosemite, and Australia, to name a few. But he decided his East Coast base would be Martinsburg, West Virginia, since his parents moved here while he was in college.
I think I got something usable.
Yeah, you did?
Yeah.
Good.
Mm-hmm. When Graham is finished recording in his outdoor office, he packs up and heads for home, where he'll mix this recording into a new tune. Here's how the one he recorded by the creek sounds. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Liz McCormick in Charlestown.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Ashton Mara. Our director is Chuck Anzalevich. I'm Beth Voorhees.